5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on. The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, 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 good evening, one and all. It is, and we missed you last week because we didn't do a show last week because couldn't be bothered, mostly. But it is the new Panic Room episode 135, which means there's been 134 shows before this one. Clever, huh? So it is Thursday night, 9:30 central, and yeah, of course the summertime savings thing started on the weekend, which was great because that meant, you know, week after spring break having to get up an hour earlier to get the kids to school. So thanks. So I blame Obama, obviously, because you can't blame Donald Trump. Okay, good God, no. No, he is blameless. God bless him. Thoughts and prayers, Donald, thoughts and prayers. Anywho. And I've missed it. We didn't get to chat last week. So I'm sure going to get the full effect this week. I did miss you last week. How are you, my dear?
I am good. I'm good. And, you know, I was going to say, you do know that because of that song now. My the boyfriend has set this as my ringtone. So, you know, if I call him, this
fantastic.
Is what he hears. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's good. You see, it's obviously stuck, hasn't it? It started off as a one-off joke, and it's stuck. It's
yeah. I don't even watch it anymore, you know.
It's great. Actually, it gets my foot tapping every week. It's great. But, I have to share this. Speaking of one-off jokes, Donald Trump Jr. has been, I think they've allowed him out. You know, he's actually been mouthing off about the whole Theresa May and Brexit thing back in England. Funnily enough, a random guy in Kroger this evening asked me about Brexit. Obviously, he heard my heard my accent and was asking me about it and whatnot. But apparently, Donald Trump Jr. is saying, you know, if Theresa May had listened to Donald Trump Sr.'s advice, it would all be sorted out by now.
Wow.
He also went on to say that she's a bit of an embarrassment. I mean, you know, popcorn and the kettle black. I mean, seriously.
Yes.
You need to look to your own, your own father, you dick.
Yeah.
Before you call other people embarrassed. At least she's not bright fucking orange and finger bangs porn stars in her spare time. Really. Although, funny enough, Theresa May does actually share her name. Here we go. 5 degrees of separation. She does actually share her name with a well-known porn star.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Okay.
So, Google Theresa May and you may well be pleasantly surprised. Or unpleasantly surprised. I mean, just some adolescent boy deciding he's going to, you know, his mum's gone out to Walmart to do a bit of shopping. So he's on his own. He's got his computer out, gets his pants down and gets his little old lad out. And he's out, Googles Theresa May to be confronted, you know, in his semi-tumescent state with imagery of the British Prime Minister. I mean, that sort of thing would just destroy. Sorry, am I disturbing you? You got something better to be doing at that end, or what?
No. Why? No.
I'm just asking. Just obviously, you know, if you're busy, I'm sorry to have disturbed. I'm sorry
to
disturb
you. I do take this time to paint my nails and drink wine. So. I mean,
that's, you know, as long as we're not interrupting all of that, you know, as long as you're not too busy. So, I ask every week because the child. Say hi, child. Say hi and then go to bed.
Hi, child.
Right. Fuck off. Go to bed. Go to bed, you nasty individual. Kids. Okay, I'm not having kids. I'm really not.
Well, that's just a turn for the worst.
Yeah, isn't it just, yeah. I do. See what I have to put up with. See what I have to put up with. You know,
they're so adorable. I say all the time that I've changed my mind about, you know, having children.
I know. Apparently, if you drop them off at the fire station steps, legally they're obliged to take them. But
that's what I heard. I think
she's 9 now, so that boat may have sailed actually.
Oh well, see, mine turned 21 today. My 21st birthday, my daughter's today.
Wow! Oh, happy birthday!
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's scary. Yeah. So that makes you old then.
I know. It does.
Yeah, you old fingers. Well, my oldest actually worked it out the other day. My oldest is 27 this year.
I say, hey, you're a little older than me then.
I may have started young. I may have started my father. No, I didn't. No, I am ancient. It's funny. I mean, my daughter, she refers to the days when I was young as the old times. The olden days. See, what was it like back in the olden days? Everything was black and white, obviously. What was it like in the olden days, Dad? Just shut up. Shut up. Did I ask you? Anywho. So I'm assuming you've got a show organized for us this week. I've no idea. No idea what's going on this week.
Definitely, we need one. You know, we missed last week and everything, so we need have a great show this week. And we do. We have a horror and crime writer, author Charles R. Rutledge, and in the second half of the show, we will have horror writer Lex Jones on. So, yay.
Excellent. That sounds like a rip-roaring show. So I think we should get it started. Because the sooner we get it started, the sooner I can go to bed. I'm absolutely shattered. I must admit, I've had a long day. I'm shattered. But it's funny, you know, as much as I can be kind of tired and I really don't. But, you know, as soon as the theme tune kicks off and that, it's great. I sort of get my second wind and it's like, it's good. I look forward to it.
Every
week. I missed it last week. Yeah. Last week was just
too.
A big boy on the first evening between 9:30 and that. I'm like, well, you know, but there's a gap in life, so, you know, it's nice. It's nice to have my hole filled, I have to say.
Definitely.
Moving on. Moving swiftly along.
Yeah, well, am I introducing the first guest?
Like,
is that what I'm doing?
Could you do that?
I could. We have for our first guest, horror/crime author Charles R. Rutledge. Woo!
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
How are you?
I am well, and you?
Good. So I have to say, if you have a great voice for audiobook reading, I have to say.
Yes.
I also have a face for radio, so it works out.
why do you think Xtina and I do a radio show and not a video podcast? There's a very, very good reason for that. So, Charles, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. Here to talk to us about your book, Dracula's Revenge.
Yes.
I like that. The tagline, where classic horror meets hard-boiled crime fiction, guns, monsters, and the world's most dangerous English professor. There's nothing left out there. You've covered all the bases. So tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, I try to do that.
You have. So, please, I want to know more about it.
Oh, okay. It is basically, what I put there, but it is a crime novel that has Bram Stoker's Dracula and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein monster in it. So, I really wanted to do the literary versions of the characters sort of picking up. It's not a sequel to the books, but I do handle them the way they are portrayed in the books.
Oh, fantastic. So I'm just reading the excerpt here because, you know, I do that. I always read ahead. And I love that, I guess it's deliberate. You have Sergeant Bill Cheney. I like that.
Yes.
I like your style. That is fantastic.
I thought I needed to get at least one of the names in there, so I decided Cheney.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. And, of course, a lot of young people, they'll be right over their heads.
Indeed. But I throw it in there for the people, you know, who will appreciate it.
As I was saying earlier, those people from the old, remember the olden times.
that would be me, yes.
And me. According to my daughter, I think I'm one of the oldest things on the planet. You know, I made the joke about having a pet dinosaur, and she actually believed me.
Oh,
I actually believed I had a pet velociraptor when I was a kid. Seriously. How old do you think I am? So Charles, I mean, I'm intrigued. I mean, where does your heart lie? Is it in crime or is it in horror?
It's more in crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've always read crime fiction since I was, you know, just a teenager. And I still read more crime fiction than anything else, but I do like horror a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So was this something you'd always want to do, sort of mix the two?
Pretty much. It's sort of how I got started. My first novel that I wrote with James A. Moore, Blind Shadows, that's how we ended up writing it, because we had been talking about doing something mixing the two. He was a horror writer and I was a crime writer, so we did, and I've continued to do that. Most of my work, either short stories, novels, novellas, generally has some aspect of that. There's cops and guns and things, and then monsters, because I love monsters.
Oh, yeah.
Who doesn't?
Oh, we all
those are great. Yeah.
So, I mean, of all the monsters, I mean, you've obviously gone right back to the classics, obviously Dracula and Frankenstein's monster. Was it just they specifically inspired you, or was it happenstance? Or
there were a couple of reasons for that. I had originally started writing Dracula's Revenge more as a Frankenstein-based book because I was doing it last year, you know, which was the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And but I liked Dracula better, and so he just kind of started taking over. So it ended up being more about him and less about the monster. So I changed it to Dracula's Revenge.
I think it's going to be
Frankenstein. Your Team Drac?
I am. I'm Team Drac, yeah.
Well, a friend of mine is another author, Dacre Stoker. He's actually the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, and he had put me onto a bunch of things, you know, like the facsimile notes from Stoker's novel and everything, which made me very interested in the character again. And I've probably read the novel at least 7 or 8 times.
Oh, wow, yeah?
Yeah, I love Dracula. I love the book, and I like the movies. Not just vampires in general, but I really like Dracula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Who is your favorite Dracula movie?
My favorite adaptation is the 1979 BBC adaptation with Louis Jordan, but he's not my favorite Dracula. But that's my favorite adaptation because they use the most from the novel.
Mm-hmm.
But Dracula himself, I would say Christopher Lee.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I was about to say, I grew up on the Hammer horror films. That was my teeth cutting as a kid. Yeah, it was Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, because Peter Cushing was always Van Helsing. Christopher Lee, for me, every time I read a Dracula book, it's there, it's Christopher Lee. You know, I enjoyed the Gary Oldman in the... the bizarrely named Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was just nothing really like the book at all. But
no, exactly.
Gary Oldman did a good. He does a good turn in that, I have to say.
We have a friend of mine and I have a running gag about that because the adaptation of that movie was written by Fred Saberhagen. So your trick question is, who wrote Bram Stoker's Dracula? Fred Saberhagen.
Was not Bram Stoker.
No, was it probably? It's like we have a novel, but we adapted it into a movie. Now we're going to adapt the movie into a different novel.
It was odd. It was good. It was well done. I mean, Keanu Reeves was horribly miscast in it, but
I don't know
how that happened. But his accent was just, obviously as a Brit, you know, his accent was just like it was painful to listen to.
Almost
as painful as Austin Powers. And anybody who listens to the show knows I am not a big fan of Austin Powers, I have to say. At all.
Yeah, that's not really one of my favorites either.
No, again, maybe it's because I'm a Brit, it just grates on me so much, that stupid accent he tries to do.
I can tell you. As a Southerner, there is nothing worse than someone trying to do a Southern accent in a movie.
Oh, God, I know.
Yeah. it should be illegal. You know, obviously the whole thing against, you know, backing up, obviously, that used to be a thing many, many years ago, but they should bring out the same sort of outrage against, you know, actors trying to do accents that's not theirs.
It's true.
If you want a Southern accent, get a Southern actor. You know, you're a British accent, get a British accent. And it's that simple.
I think they do a lot more now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, early on, no, it was just whomever. And, I've some truly atrocious Southern accents over the years.
Oh, my goodness me, yes. But, again, for me, I've been brought up in England. I mean, you know, it was just an American accent. And for me, an American accent, that was it. It was just they were all the same.
Sure.
But obviously, they're not. I know that. I just people all over the country now, and it's amazing. I'm starting to pick out the accents now a little bit, so it's interesting.
It is. And, you know, I'm horrible. You know, there's people out there who can do a good accent. They can, you know, fake any accent out there. And I am just, in my head, I will think something in a different accent, and then I'll go to say it, and Oh, it's awful. I just butcher it every single time. I don't even know why I try anymore, but I still do occasionally. You know, I'll hear something
to be fair,
and I'll sort of say it. Nope, I mean, nothing.
To be fair, Epstein, you butcher things in your own accent anyway, so...
I do.
You know.
I do. I do. For somebody who enjoys writing and, you know, and reading as much as I do, I'm not so much for the speeching part, and I love to say that, yeah.
Speeching. You know,
exactly,
the little speeching bit. Yeah, well done. Well done,
I mess up the speeching all the time. So that's one reason that, you know, I'm horrible at doing... you know, the excerpts. We've had, you know, some of our lady guests will come on and they will, you know, say, to me, they don't really want to read their excerpts. And I'm so glad that so far everybody has done it because, you know, I start going way too fast and then I start getting sweaty and nervous and it's just a mess. It really is. So I'm glad that we don't have any kind of, you know, script that we have to read because, well, you know, that might be funny right there. That could be a show. It'd go on our blooper show, but I think that maybe people would tune in just to hear me mess up.
No, definitely. I would. Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, right. So I want to hear more about Dracula's Revenge. Do you have an excerpt for us, Charles?
I do have an excerpt.
Yay!
Let me find my Kindle here so I can read it.
Fantastic. Okay.
I have this thing keyed up. I was paying attention, mostly.
This is my favorite part. I get to drink more.
Well, good. I'll try to make it, you know, drinkable sort of reading.
Yay. All right.
This is from Chapter 12 with Sergeant Bill Cheney.
Yay.
Sergeant Bill Cheney was as good as his word. He showed up at the paper mill a little after midnight and made a slow circuit in his replacement cruiser with its replacement spotlight. The beam seemed pale and inadequate in the fog that rolled in with darkness. Jen and DeCamp watched Cheney from behind what had once been an equipment shack. When Cheney finally pulled out of the parking lot, they moved from concealment and crossed to one of the side gates. Jen hefted the sturdy padlock and chain which hung from the gate. "Did you bring bolt cutters, or is lock picking among your skills?" DeCamp said. "Not precisely." He stepped over and grasped the padlock in his left hand. Jen heard DeCamp mumble something under his breath, and the padlock snapped open. Jen said, "What the hell did you just do?" "I opened the lock." "I know you opened the lock, Carter. Was that actual magic?" DeCamp shrugged. "Something like that." "Okay, I have seen you do some strange things, but that was just creepy. What else can you do?" "Very little, really. Thousands of years ago, sorcery was common in this world. Now it barely exists. The laws have changed, and most of what you would term magic won't work anymore. I know a few tricks." "What was that you mumbled?" "Some words from a language older than recorded history, Jennifer. Now, let's get inside the gate in case your friend the sergeant comes back." They stepped through the gate, and DeCamp hung the padlock back in place without locking it. The ground inside the gate was littered with bricks and other debris, so they had to move carefully. Jen was aware of the sound of the river and the smell of the marshlands behind the building. They were halfway to the main building when a figure appeared out of the fog. It wasn't Bill's monster, far from it. It was a tall, statuesque woman with flowing red hair, dressed in a white gown. The rippling fabric of the gown almost seemed to glow in the fog. Jen froze in place. DeCamp held his sheathed sword in his left hand. He slowly drew the weapon. He said, "If she attacks, get clear." The woman opened her deep red lips and hissed like some great cat. Her sharp white teeth glistened in the mist. She crouched and her hands came up, long fingers hooked like claws. "Shit," Jen said, automatically reaching for her Glock, which wasn't there, of course. It was sitting in the forensics lab back in Gatesville. Her heart was beating overtime as she remembered what happened to George and Dan. The woman took a step forward, and DeCamp raised the slender sword, pointing the tip at the vampire. She made a snarling sound and drew even closer. Jen caught movement out of the corner of her eye and glanced to her right. Two more women, also garbed in flowing white, were slowly approaching out of the fog. Jen flashed on her recent rereading of Dracula. What was it with the count and brides in groups of three? Carter, there are more of them. I see them, DeCamp said. Without looking away from the red-haired woman, he dug into a pocket of his jacket and brought out an ornate silver crucifix. The vampire flinched when she saw it. DeCamp held it out to Jen. Take this, hurry. I'm not a Christian, nor am I. It doesn't matter. They can't stand religious relics, no matter who wields them. Apparently, the movie she'd seen had gotten that part wrong. Jen took the cross. As she did so, the redhead launched herself at DeCamp. If the vampire expected DeCamp to retreat, she was disappointed. The slender man lunged straight into her attack with the silver-edged sword extended and ran the blade directly through the woman's heart. Even as the red-haired vampire fell, DeCamp whipped the sword clear and turned to face the other two vampire women. Only one of them was headed his way, though. The other was stalking toward Jen. Jen backpedaled, holding the crucifix straight out in front of her. The vampire, a slender black woman, growled and hissed, but she didn't close the distance. Jen tried to twist so that she could see what was happening with DeCamp without looking away from the vampire. DeCamp's second opponent leaped at him as the first had, but evaded the point of the deadly blade and managed to lock one hand around DeCamp's wrist, pinning the sword. Without hesitation, DeCamp dropped the weapon, grabbed the woman's own wrist, and pivoted, executing a throw of some sort. Jen knew that the vampire was probably much stronger than a human being, but caught off guard, she went sprawling. She was up in an instant, however, and rushing back at DeCamp as he stooped to retrieve the sword. It looked like she would be on top of him before he could get the weapon, but his left hand swung up and a haze of dust flew into the vampire's face. DeCamp muttered some more of the weird language, and the dust ignited. The momentary flash set the vampire ablaze. She shrieked and stumbled around, her hair and gown wreathed in flame. Unfortunately, it also diverted Jen's attention from her own vampire for a half second, and the woman struck out, slapping the crucifix away. Jen tried to go after it, but the vampire caught her shoulder and spun her back around. Snarling, the woman hit Jen with an open-handed blow that sent her to the ground, sending spasms of pain through Jen's injured ribs. The vampire grinned, showing all her razor teeth, and reached toward Jen with a talon-like hand. Her grin became a grimace as a jagged piece of wood erupted from the slender woman's chest, sending blood spraying. As Jen watched, the vampire was lifted from the ground, still impaled on the wooden lance. She tried to scream, but blood gurgled from her mouth. Her thrashings and flailing weakened, and when she was still, whoever was holding the makeshift spear let her fall. Jen looked up to find Bill's monster looming gigantic in the fog. In the flickering firelight, Jen could see the yellow skin and the long black hair, but it was the eyes that held her attention. They were staring at her, not with malice, but with curiosity and concern. "Thank you for your help," DeCamp said from close by. Jen half turned to find that DeCamp was standing just behind her. The giant nodded at DeCamp. Then, in a deep, rasping voice, he said, "There are more of them around, but not their master. We should go." DeCamp reached down and helped Jen to her feet. She wasn't feeling any too steady as she stood. DeCamp said, "Yes, that's probably best. However, I'd like to talk to you soon." The huge man said, "We will talk. Now go. The police may return." "There's something I have to do first," DeCamp said. As Jen watched, DeCamp walked over to the vampire the monster had killed and struck off her head with the sword. Then he moved to the almost extinguished remains of the other vampire and did the same. He finished with the first one he had slain. "They'll crumble the dust soon now," DeCamp said. "Let's get out of here, Jennifer." "What about?" Jen began, turning toward the giant. But when she turned, he had vanished into the fog. She turned back to DeCamp. "What the hell was that thing?" DeCamp said. "Though I'm having a hard time believing it. Unless I'm mistaken, that was the Frankenstein monster."
Oh, I like that. That was so good.
Oh, thank you.
I like that. Yeah.
And you read it so good. You know, could you stay after the show and just read it to me? Just read the book to me.
read all of it.
Read you the novella.
Yeah. I would like that. Yeah.
Well, awesome. No, but
no,
in a word, no. But
you know, I am so embarrassed to say this, but I don't know a whole lot about Dracula. Like, you know, Dracula played on. Dracula was on Buffy once. You know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He
sure.
was on it. And that's, you know, that's pretty much my what I know about Dracula.
Well, he's been in everything. I mean, he's, you know, obviously he's one of the most filmed characters from fiction, probably only exceeded by Sherlock Holmes. And
wow.
He's appeared in, you know, comic books and TV series and you name it. The Dracula's been in it. But the novel itself, as I say, I've read it many times, not just because I'm interested in horror, but I actually find it to be a very good novel. I enjoy it tremendously.
I will.
Yeah,
maybe I should rectify that.
I read it when I was a youngster, actually, and I found it, obviously, because it's obviously the Gothic style, I found very, very heavy. Maybe I need to revisit it sort of now, but I know
give
I was
it
probably
yeah, give it another
12
try.
Or 13, and it was just like, I plowed through it. But it was heavy going for that age, I think, you know. I'd only just really started. I've just graduated from, you know, kiddie monster books to I'd read James Herbert's The Rats, which was my first grown up horror novel. But I tried Frankenstein. I think I only managed half of Frankenstein. Again, got so bogged down with it. It was just maybe I was a bit young to really appreciate it then.
Well, I don't really enjoy Frankenstein that much. I've read it, I think, twice, and the second time was right before I wrote this. And it is slow, and it rambles. I've read a lot of the Gothic novels, you know, like Walpole and Mysteries of Udolpho, The Castle of Otranto, The Monk, and Melmoth the Wanderer, all the classic four. But they are very, very hard-going, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then again, you know, I recently tried to read Anne Rice, and that for different reasons that was heavy. Obviously, she's not a Gothic style, but I thought I'd got into page 20. She was still describing New Orleans.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I get on with the damn story, woman. You know, I don't
I
need
all.
I don't know if you guys ever read any Richard Adams, who wrote Watership Down. I read his book, The Plague Dogs. I was actually given it as a birthday present as a kid. And he described like the Yorkshire Wolds, the Yorkshire Moors, page after page after. You can only describe Heather so many times, you know. But
oh, yeah.
He managed 6 pages describing the Heather. So, brilliant, thanks. That's great.
That makes me think of the middle book in The Lord of the Rings, when they're running across Rohan after the hobbits, and Tolkien described every step. You know, he took a step, and then he took another step, and then he leapt upon a rock and ran through some grass and took some more steps through some trees. And this goes on for 30 pages.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So
I think... Tolkien was—he was padding, wasn't it?
Oh golly! I think he just enjoyed that. But since I do, since I read a lot of crime fiction, and a lot of that, you know, is fairly terse.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the rules that Elmore Leonard used for his own writing is one I have adopted, which is I try to leave out the parts people skip.
Because
I like a fast-paced book. You know.
But
Dracula, yeah, give it another
yeah.
try, because I think
I'm gonna have to, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should buddy read that together. What's
buddy read? What does that mean? you read it out to me or what?
No, you read it and I read it and we discuss it. That's amazing.
Oh, could we not do that?
You could take turns. Because, you know, it's written as letters and journal entries and things. So you could just, you know, you could take turns. It'd be great.
You know, I'd really rather not, if you don't mind.
Okay. The funny thing is, you know, it's actually was one of Sir Christopher Lee's favorite books, which is one of the reasons he kept taking the role, even though he didn't like it that much.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah. He didn't like the scripts. You know, he did that one Spanish version because they let him look the way Dracula actually looked, with the white hair and the mustache and everything, as opposed to being, you know, sort of the suave Dark vampire.
It was good, like you're saying. I think it's the role that he will always be. And he did many roles over the years.
I
think he will always be Dracula. I mean, he was in. I think he was the only actor that was in. I think the three main franchises. He was in Star Wars. He was in obviously Lord of the Rings. I think he's probably in Harry Potter as well at some point. But he was like in everything. For me, one of my favorite roles was in The Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man, yeah.
I watched that not long ago. Great. Not the Nicolas Cage version, I have to say. It was terrible.
Not the bees.
The bees. Yeah, it was funny, that. Inadvertently funny, but it was funny. The original Wicker Man with
Edward Woodward.
Britt Eklund. Who could forget Britt Eklund's turn in that?
Yes. Yeah, that's a very strange movie. It's halfway a musical and halfway a horror movie.
Yeah, and he wears a dress, puts a wig on, and wears a dress and dances around, and but it works. It's funny enough, actually, I'm working on, for me actually, we're working on a novel at the moment. He sort of takes some inspiration from The Wicker Man, and I'm not going to say any more than that because it's only half written. So there.
Interesting.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that because I enjoyed that sort of rural horror.
Yeah, it's some of the themes are there. So, I need somebody in drag, obviously.
Well, yeah, you gotta have that.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
I think Xtine is just sort of. I'm lost now.
Yeah.
What's going on?
We've wandered off into Christopher Lee Land.
I'm trying to think of my wealth of knowledge of, even when it comes to, like, older, and when I say older, it's going to make me sound young or whatever, like, vampire stuff. And I love Jerry Dandridge from Fright Night, okay?
Sure.
He's awesome.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
I love Fright Night.
Right?
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I just, very recently, because it pops up on my free movies on my cable, just watched the Colin Farrell version.
That's pretty good too.
And they did a damn fine job with it. I didn't realize, it's been a while since I've seen it. It's actually Anton Yelchin plays the hero, because he died tragically. He would have been 30 this year.
Yep.
Run over by his own Lexus. Rather sadly. Yeah.
I don't have any problems with remakes. I really don't. And sometimes they're really good. And I did not mind that one. I really didn't. But I still love the original. I mean, I remember that played a huge part of my childhood because I watched it over and over again. And I had this huge crush on Jerry Dandridge. So, that was the original for me on that one.
It's just a fun movie. And, and they have since Roddy McDowall, plays Harry Vincent, the horror host. And, and I come from that generation of people who grew up with, the Friday Night Frights. And here in Atlanta, the horror host was Dead Ernest. And there was a guy, he'd come out and introduce the movies and shock theater, that kind of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say this, but we're just about out of time for our first segment.
I want to stay up all night and talk about old movies, to be honest.
I would love to do that, but I understand.
You have to promise to come back and see us, Charles.
I will. Well, I'm actually writing the sequel to the Dracula's Revenge right now, so I'll have another one eventually.
Fantastic.
We will get
Charles on for the whole show. We'll just talk about old movies.
We can sit and talk about old movies. You bet. That would be a good time.
Definitely.
Awesome. I thank you for coming on, Charles, and I'll be bugging you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Charles. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All right, you guys, take care.
Okay, and you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
And we will be right back after these messages.
Panic Pilgrim Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
Let the good times roll. Got a long dog, Sally, got stagger lead, showing lots of personality. Here to Jerry Lee, rock and roll revival show. Pour me a little more of that good old elderberry wine. Get down, get down, get down till you get it when it feels so fine. Great balls of fire, honey, turn out the lights. I'm gonna be good at rocking tonight. Here to Jerry Lee, rock and roll the Bible show. Come on and shake, baby, let me see you move. Feel so good when you're doing what you wanna do. Oh, lock all the doors, let's get the Dixie Prize. Everybody here gonna have a little fun tonight. Early in the morning when it's breaking dawn, we'll have a party still going on at Jerry Lee's Rock and Roll Revival Show. Yeah. Over by the telephone. Good golly, and Miss Molly, won't you leave that poor cowboy alone? They got rock and roll fever, got the boogie woogie blues. Come in and yell, baby, let Jerry show you what you do. Jerry Lee, rock and roll revival show. Come on now, Jerry Lee, rock and roll revival show. Jerry Lee, rock and roll
show. Duh! Welcome yeah. Back to part two.
Well, couldn't resist a bit of Jerry Lee Lewis there, which for me is classical music. So there you go.
Yeah, we've had great music on the show tonight. We should do that some night. Just, you know, just have a bunch of music. I'm on board for that.
We should do that one night. Just line up a shit ton of music and just play some slamming tunes, I think.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah, just cut out all the bullshit banter from us too. You know, it's because yeah, people don't pay to listen to that. You know, nobody needs that. In their lives.
Are you sure?
I'm quite sure. It'd be great if people did pay to hear it, but not happened yet. To be fair, people may actually pay us to shut up.
You know that we should think about that. Yeah,
we should do that. We'll just waffle on until people. You know, once we hit our benchmark amount, then we'll be quiet for a bit. So see how quickly
like
the money rolls in. I great. A reverse telethon. That would work.
It might.
I'd probably donate as well, to be honest.
Just to shut us up, yeah, really.
just to shut us up. Just for fuck's sake, people. Anywho. So, hey, we've got a bit of a cheat for our second half. We did pre-record because our guest is over in England, which is kind of neat. Mm-hmm. So the time, because their clocks haven't gone back yet, so the time's all over the place, to be honest. I'm not sure what time it is in England, right? In fact, I'm going to check, because I've got a thing on my phone, actually, that tells me world clock. It is
like
3 o'clock in the morning.
Wow,
it is 3 o'clock in the morning. I think it's actually 7 hours now, because their clocks haven't gone forward yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, I know, because my dad phoned me today, and it was, he normally phones around 1 o'clock my time, but it was like 2 o'clock, so I thought, he's not going to ring me today. And then, of course, their clocks don't go back till the very last weekend of, I'm boring myself, I have to say. I'm just waffling on. What is the point? What is the point? So, anywho, let's, I'm going to press the button, because I'm going to let you introduce him.
Okay, well, for our second guest, we have horror writer Lex Jones. Woo!
Hi, Lex. How you doing?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good. We're well. How's things in sunny Sheffield?
It is actually sunny today. It's the weather's pretty good.
Excellent, Sheffield. I tell everybody who listen, my family are actually originally from Sheffield. My grandparents are from there. So, and I grew up in Doncaster, which is literally hop, skip. We used to be able to bike to Sheffield from there. So, say hello to God's own country for me, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Whereabouts in Sheffield? I mean, this will be over the heads of anybody else listening. But whereabouts in Sheffield are you?
I live in North Sheffield in the countryside.
Yeah, what's the village called? Or what's the suburb called?
I live in the north of Sheffield, right on the Peak District. It's all like moorlands and forests and stuff where I am. I'm not in the city.
Oh, it is lovely. There's some fantastic. The Peak District is. We always used to go on school trips there, like, you know, always.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful up there. I'm jealous.
Yeah,
I'm dead
nice.
Jealous.
Yeah.
So, Lex is here to talk to us about his phenomenal novel, The Other Side of the Mirror, which is I probably upset all our authors when I say this. Probably one of the best I've read in a long time.
It's really good. Yeah.
I'm usually incredibly good at sniffing out plot twists. I mean, I've figured out the sixth sense, you know, in the opening credits, to be honest. But this absolutely, again, I'm not going to spoil it, but the twist just jumps up and grabs you by the whatnot. So well done. You actually had me fooled, Lex. So.
I'm trying to be really careful so I don't give anything away. And I know going into this. Yeah, no, I am looking at the title, and I'm always trying to figure out where does the title fit in. But I was so sucked into the story and the characters and, you know, the world that he created that I wasn't even thinking about that. So when the plot twist does happen, I was completely off guard. I mean, I was like I remember actually talking out loud. Like, I was like, oh, my God, no, that didn't just happen. It was so cool. It was such a great moment because I don't normally have that kind of reaction.
It's nice when you get a twist that works like that. I mean, I know, speaking of the Sixth Sense, I mean, M. Night Shyamalan, I mean, he was known for it. But I was going to say, we really should send this to him, but he'd just spoil it, I think.
Right.
You know, he peaked with, I mean, you know, Sixth Sense was a great twist. I think he probably peaked then, to be honest with you. I mean, after that, you know, they were just either predictable or... I mean, there was the one... What was it called? Was it called The Devil or Satan or something, where they were all stuck in a lift?
Oh, yeah. The elevator,
yeah. I predicted that plot twist from the poster outside the movie theatre, to be honest. But I still sat through it, and it was a dreadful, dreadful film. But again, Lex will identify with this. You know, being a Yorkshireman, never walk out of a film, no matter how bad it is, because you put it on. I'm prepared to say this. I'm not moving. You know.
Yeah, that's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like The Village. I thought The Village was really good.
I liked that one. I defend that one quite often in horror discussion. I think that is actually a good film, especially the second time. When you know what the ending is and you're not going to be disappointed by the lack of monsters in it, I think it's actually a really good film.
Well, I didn't understand was how come, you know, there were no airplanes flying overhead anything like, I mean, you can't, just even the most isolated spots, you know, there's always some, you know, it takes an aircraft flying overhead and the whole thing's blown.
Yes,
it was a bit of a suspension of disbelief, unless I suppose they owned the airspace above the colony as well.
That's pushing it a bit, isn't it? Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned The Sixth Sense, because that kind of a twist is actually what I was trying to avoid with this book, because the problem I have with twists like that is that that's all there is to it. If you watch The Sixth Sense when you know the twist, it's a very boring film. It's not particularly interesting. The characters aren't particularly interesting. So like what Tina said about like the story itself is interesting before you even get to the twist, and you arguably don't necessarily need it. That's more what I was going for. I didn't want to write a mediocre book that then ends with a massive twist, and that seems to be what Shyamalan always does. The film itself is kind of mediocre, but then it's got a memorable twist, so it fools you into thinking that the whole thing was fantastic, but actually it's just the twist that's impressed you.
Yeah,
I see that. I loved the characters. I really did. I loved Carl and Jimmy. That was the, you know, his friend, right, Jimmy? I loved Jimmy. I did. I could see him in my head. And while I think the twist was great, and I that moment was such a shock to me, and I was so like, wow, I didn't see it coming, you know, and that was amazing. But, I don't know if, I mean, yeah, I think it was needed just because it was so cool. But I could see it without it too, and the story was definitely could, you know, held its own. So it was great. I loved it. I really did.
Thank you.
I was impressed.
I assume next year. You know, she does this to me every time. You know, I'm trying to talk, and she's blabbing on. You know, never work with animals, children, and women. I think is the. Is the theme here. We mentioned Arthur M. Knight. I mean, who inspired you to, I mean, who inspires you generally, but who specifically for Other Side of the Mirror? Where was the inspiration coming from?
Interestingly for that, I watched two sort of films in quite short succession. I watched the adaptations of Sin City from Frank Miller's graphic novels, and then I watched the Watchmen film from Alan Moore, specifically focused on the Rorschach's sort of like narrative parts of that film, and I just really like that kind of film noir sort of style where there's like that overarching sort of feel to it, and I just wondered if I could write anything like that. So it kind of started as an experiment, really. I just sort of sat down and started writing, trying to capture this sort of voice of how a noir sort of thing would feel, and I just sort of quite fell in love with that style. I quite liked doing it, so then I decided I'd actually come up with a plot and write that plot. But the more I wrote it, the more I sort of started pushing the boundaries of what that could be. Like, I mean, you've both read it, so you know that there's some slightly surreal stuff in it. It never goes full on. There's nothing supernatural in it. There's nothing like that. But it has some definitely, like, pulpy sort of elements in that it kind of pushes towards being a bit weird in places. It's got, like, that David Lynch sort of feel in parts.
Yeah.
Where things are just slightly on the verge of being not quite real, but never fully diving into the soup.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, like you say, it doesn't need the supernatural thing. I mean, it's noir and pulp. I love the style. You know, that's I sort of grew up reading that sort of thing. So it's incredible. I mean, is that your background, or, you know, are you wanting to do more supernatural and monsters, or?
Do we lose him?
he's gone again. He's gone again. Hello?
You know, I was thinking of...
Oh, sorry, go on.
I was thinking of the, you know, what you're saying about Stephen King, and I think, you know, for me, a number of his books would have been just as good, if not better, without the supernatural aspect in it.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I think, yeah, there's been a couple. I think Rose Mather would have been better without the supernatural.
Exactly. Yes, definitely.
I think even Under the Dome, I mean, the word loosely, the twist to that was just terrible, but the book itself was fantastic. If he just, instead of the spoiler alert, the pitiful explanation, it's almost like, oh, I've got to finish this. I'm 2,000 pages in, I need to finish this. Oh, let's throw some aliens in, you know. And it's like, no. Even, funnily enough, I mean, the Simpsons did the same idea where they put a dome over Springfield. And that was done better. That was done so much better than King's twist. But again, I love reading that. I find that with King a lot. You know, it's more of it is the journey. You know, rather than the end. Even with which is my favorite King book.
I was going to say
the end. The end was left me a little bit disappointed, but getting there was phenomenal. You know, he created those characters so incredibly well.
Exactly. I loved the kids. I loved the story. The dialogue between the kids and everything is great, and then you do get to the end and you're like, really, that's what it is, you know. So
it's a giant spider. Yeah, thanks Steve. Thanks Steve, that's great.
So, but it almost is like with him, he does get to a certain point where he's just like, I am so tired of writing this, I am just gonna throw something in there at you guys and you know, let you sort it out or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they do notice
his
often.
Books usually focus more on the people, though, don't they? And then, like you said, there's sometimes a supernatural bit thrown in, and it doesn't always need it.
Nope, doesn't at all, I don't think. Yeah. And I love a character-driven book. I want to get invested in the characters. I think that's what I think a lot of writers out there these days are so into the story. Where, you know, if I'm not invested in the characters, I don't care what the story is. So,
sure, yeah. Well,
that is the mark of a good book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, definitely. Sorry, I was just going to say, this is the first thing I've written that isn't supernatural, actually. All my other published work is, I've got a lot of short horror stories published. I did a kind of a literary fiction book a couple of years back that's about God and the devil spending a year sort of on Earth as people. And then the books I've got coming out later this year are supernatural themed. So that generally is what I write. The Other Side of the Mirror was the first one I've done that isn't, that's just sort of like purely based in a version of reality. I quite like doing it. So, I mean, there is actually one of the books I've got planned is, I wouldn't call it a sequel, but it is kind of another book set in the same city with some of the same characters, and chronologically it does take place after The Other Side of the Mirror, but I wouldn't call it a sequel because that story is kind of open and shut, so it's not
right.
There aren't any threads for it to really carry on from, but it does feature some of the same characters.
Oh, that's cool. It's in the same universe. I like that. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just think sometimes a sequel's unnecessary. You just kind of force it to carry on when it doesn't need to. So there's nothing to carry on from. That story finishes. So it's just got to be another story with some of the same people in it, really.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you create such great characters, it's a shame not to do something more with them.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I want to hear more. Do you have a reading for us, Lex?
Yes, I do. Just bear with me one second because I don't have that to hand, actually.
It's okay. We can have gaps. We can cut them all out in post.
Right.
We're all good.
I have to switch laptop that I was using. Yeah, I had to switch onto my work laptop because my other one just wasn't having Skype at all when I was trying to set it up before.
I need a nap today. It's dark and dreary here and a little colder.
It's a lovely sunny day here today. It's nice.
No, we're gonna have some rain. It was nice yesterday and the day before, but it's dark and kind of chilly, and it's gonna rain. I hope it doesn't rain before I get out there and get my walk. We've been walking again, finally.
Oh, wow, yay.
Yeah, yay. Right behind us, they're building another road to the, like, subdivision, and it's kind of cool to walk down there with, like, there's no cars, and it's not completed yet. It's kind of spooky, actually, but I like it.
Yeah.
Right, so I've got the book.
Are we ready? Are we ready? Excellent.
Yep. I'm just going to read kind of the opening chapter, because I think the way the book flows, as you both know, to just kind of jump in at any random point, it'll not make any narrative sense. So I think you do need to start from the beginning with to do a sample of this.
Yep, fine. That works. Yeah, good thinking. Right, whenever
okay.
You're ready, go for it. Yep, go for it.
Right, so The Other Side of the Mirror, Chapter 1, and this chapter is called The Sticks. She's beautiful, Detective Trent remarked as he stared down at the pale form of the young woman before him. Her blonde hair and dark clothes were soaked with dirty water, but her skin was still soft and white, her lips a pale blue, giving her an even more ethereal quality. They were pouting slightly with the way the blood vessels had been swollen by the icy water. They always are, Detective Duggan sighed, watching Trent take one final drag on his cigarette before dropping it into the depths of the river before him. He was right, of course. They always looked beautiful when they were dead, because they weren't really people anymore. You didn't know them, know their sins, their crime, or their thoughts. The ice-cold waters of the river had baptized them, washing away the amassed sins of a life lived in the city, leaving them clean and innocent and beautiful, always beautiful. The river ran straight through the middle of the city, separating the rich side from the poor. To see it on a map, it looked like God had drawn a thick black line through the societal plan, keeping the dogs away from their masters. Up close, there wasn't much difference between one side of that line and the other, except that pimps and crack whores were replaced with corrupt bankers and high-class call girls. Poor filth and rich filth, separated by an expanse of ebony water. You live here long enough and you learn that. If the filth from the east side made enough money to get across the river, then they'd join the filth in the west side. No one ever left the city once they'd arrived. It wouldn't let them. Who do you think she was? Trent asked as he looked down again at the frozen face of the dead girl. She can't be older than 19 and she's wearing a designer bracelet, Duggan remarked, crouching next to the body. Only one place a girl on this side of the city gets money like that, and it's the same place she'd get the bruise on her wrist. She's a hooker, Trent nodded. She was, Duggan sighed. Now she's just another one for the morgue. You think she was drowned? No, shot in the chest, Duggan replied, opening the young girl's sodden blouse slightly to reveal the bullet wound above her heart. The fact there was no blood or bullet hole in the blouse suggested a poor attempt to hide the wound. Someone was rushing. That's quite a shot to make. Unless you're up close, which means there's a good chance she knew the guy, probably argued with him, pleaded and begged, and he shot her anyway. You think she forgot to pay a pimp? Trent suggested. I don't know, that seems unlikely. What makes you say that? Look at her clothes, the jewellery. Girl doesn't make that kind of money her first year on the streets, Trent. She's experienced, been in the game a while. Forgetting to pay a boss isn't something she'd suddenly start to do. Maybe she got overconfident, tried to leave town and he wouldn't let her. Where would she go? Besides, classy or not, she still dressed like a tramp. She wasn't going anywhere nice tonight, just out to the streets. So we've got a mystery on our hands, huh? When you're a detective, they call it a case, Trent. Hey, quit with the smart mouth, wiseass. I've been on the force longer than you. Yeah, how could I forget that? Duggan muttered, standing up from the body. Wait for the meat wagon to pick her up. I'm calling it a night. Trent took his tiny silver hip flask and knocked contents hit his throat like ice water. He coughed a little and then relaxed as he swallowed it down. It wasn't the body. He'd seen enough of them that nothing shocked him. Not kids, not women, nothing fazed him now. It was the cold, the rain. The city never seemed to shake it off, whatever the season. Trent wasn't even certain what season it was about now. He was sure he'd seen some Christmas lights being set up, but they put the damn things out in September now, so who can tell? Winter would bring snow instead of rain, but the cold would stay. Trent resigned himself to this and brought up the collar on his grey coat, watching his breath as it drifted away into the night before his eyes. Duggan walked on down by the banks of the Sticks. The river had earned that name so long ago that no one could remember what it was actually called. It was a name that had been earned in the blood of everyone whose corpse had sank to the bottom of it, a debt paid 1,000 times over and an account that would be forever in credit. Duggan could remember a body being dragged from it at least once every couple of months for as long as he'd been on the force, which was approaching 2 decades now. There were probably more down there beneath the black mire that blocked any light from penetrating past 3 or 4 feet of water. Rotting bodies, food for whatever fish could survive down there, long past seeing the light and wondering if their families even knew they were gone. The girl who'd washed up on the shore tonight wasn't even the youngest Duggan had seen. There had been 2 kids, each aged 12, who had been strangled and tied together at the waist. They'd never found out who did that or why, and that haunted Duggan more than the dead faces of those damn kids. Not having an answer taunted him. He couldn't let things go. To have the devil standing right there in front of him, holding a piece of paper with the answer written in invisible ink, it ate away at his gut, left a burning feeling of emptiness and rage inside that nothing would quell. Carl Duggan liked answers. To leave a question without one was a pain that wouldn't die. The corpses still at the bottom of the sticks might never have their answers found. They didn't even have names anymore. Duggan didn't think about them, as that way madness lie. Tonight, his focus was on the girl. His shift was over, it was time to return home. But still, his thoughts were on the latest victim of the city's cruel will. A city where the young die and no one ever lives long enough to claim social security. It was like some form of purgatory with a constant turnover of its residents. The only people who stayed here past a couple of years were the cops and the career criminals. Everyone else died young. No one ever left, not once the city had marked you. It was like a disease, an infection of sin that rots you from the inside out. Once it's in your soul, it's going nowhere, and neither are you. You'll just take it with you, spread it wherever you go. The darkness, the soul-crushing misery, the cold and the rain. Better to stay here, quarantine within the city limits. Let the darkness and the filth and the cold eat away at those who've chosen that fate, but keep it here, where it belongs. 2 halves of a dirt-covered coin separated by a river of blood. The walk home wasn't a long one, but Carl took it slow, cleared his head, letting mull over his thoughts before he got home. Once he unlocked his front door and stepped inside, he'd like to leave the city behind him. Turn the lights on, drink some coffee that didn't taste like pig crap, and sit down in a chair that wasn't 40-year-old hard plastic. An escape, a refuge, somewhere to leave the dark and the cold behind for a while. It never went completely away, of course, not with the neon sign whose pink glow taunted the gap between his bedroom curtains. It used to read, "Jesus saves," but now it simply said, "Save." The sign broke years back and was never fixed. Who would bother? Not like anyone in the city wants to read that message, not that they ever did. Hope needed light and warmth to spread, and there was precious little to be found here. Maybe in the arms of a hooker for half an hour, but even that would cost you your cash and your soul. A heavy price to empty your sack into a stranger, but there was never a shortage of those who wanted to pay it. Everyone needs joy, wherever it is to be found, whatever the cost. Line up for eternal damnation, smile at the devil as he takes your picture. The third stair on the way up to Carl's apartment creaked beneath his shoe as it did whenever he walked on it. Every time he heard that noise, he contemplated telling the superintendent, but decided against it. Surely men like that don't care about creaking steps. They just want to change the light bulbs and go home. Maybe mop the floors if they're feeling adventurous. If nothing else, the creaking step would always serve to alert the cheating wife in the flat above Carl's every time her husband was on his way home.
I think he disappeared on us. That was great, though. I have to say that, you know, for me, when, you know, I get caught into, you know, a story right away, and it's either right away or I don't at all, you know. And I loved even the beginning, you know, the first line of this. And I was like, I want to know what's going on here. I want to know, you know, more to the story.
Yeah, I mean, he watched the Sin City movies, and he paints that kind of grim, you know, desperate sort of aura around the whole thing. I was there. Again, it's a lot like Sheffield used to be back in the 70s, actually.
it's like, you know. I don't even live in the city he's writing about, but I want to move. You know, I'm like, no, it's too dreary here. I have to move. Yeah. I don't even live there. It was great.
Can you guys hear me again?
We can now. We lost you. It was that's fine. It was we were just saying that was, you know, it sets the scene perfectly. You know, just the characters. I don't know if you heard me. Like, you know, it just reminded me a lot of Sheffield back in the '70s. You know, which was very. remember that Sheffield was one of the places where they built massive tower box, big grey concrete tower box to sort of, you know, pack people in as an alternative to actual proper housing estates. And I think that they've pulled them all down, I think, pretty much now, but there's some real horrible places there for quite some time.
It's not like that now, but it was for quite a long time. Yeah, my memories of going into the city centre as a child was that it was always quite a grey and intimidating place, whereas now it's actually officially one of the greenest cities in the country. It's full of trees and garden areas, and all them blocks have come down, and it doesn't look like that at all anymore. It's great.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice, yeah. But I'll have to come back.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the opening to the book that you were describing, that actually, it's interesting. I often start in the middle of a book and then sort of decide what the beginning is going to be later. But with this one, that was always the opening scene. Just the two detectives stood looking at a beautiful dead girl on the sides of this river. That was always the opening, because immediately I thought, you want to know what's happened here and who she is and who they are. And that, even for me, because I didn't even know any of those questions myself when I first started writing it, that was just the image that I had in my head, and that was immediately the beginning of it. And that is rare for me to know the opening scene. I usually know all the middle stuff and know how it ends, but where to jump in on a story is quite tricky for me.
Yeah.
Well, you did a great job of it. Great job of just, you know, painting the picture wonderfully. And, even making me say, I want to know who this girl is. I want to know who this, you know, who this detective is. And, you know, and I just love that it felt so, a lot of times when I'm reading a story, well, I don't know about a lot of times, but sometimes I'm turned off right away because it just feels so one-dimensional. You know, you feel like you're not seeing everything, and the characters aren't really fleshed out really good. Well, you know, this is like the total opposite of that. I mean, right away, you know, these characters, they have substance to them right away, you know, and I don't know. It was great. I can't wait to read more from you. I really can't. What are you working on now?
At the moment, I've got two kind of things going in parallel. I'm finishing off a collection of short stories of my own that a publisher has expressed an interest in. I've got a children's weird fiction book that a different publisher is interested in, and I've had artwork done for that and everything. I'm kind of working on those in parallel at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So what made you decide to do a children's book? That's an interesting tangent.
Very similar to the writing The Other Side of the Mirror. It was like an experiment. Like, I wonder if I can do this. I'd got like the genesis of an idea, and I thought, I wonder if I can actually do this properly. And I did it, and the response was amazing. Everyone who was read it was so excited by it. And then a friend of mine writes comic books for a living, so I asked him to do the artwork for it. And everyone just fell in love with that artwork completely. It was just an experiment that sort of turned into something more, really. I can give you the basis of what the story's about, if you're interested.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Right, well, the book is called The Old One and the Sea, and it's a reimagining of H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, basically. And it tells a story of H.P. Lovecraft when he was a little boy, and it's Howard, and he lives in this seaside village. I've fictionalized it all. It's not actually biographical, but he lives in this seaside town called Innsmouth, and one night there's a volcanic eruption that brings this black reef up to the side of the coast where he lives, and with it comes this ancient creature which he calls Ulu, because he can't pronounce its name, and he sort of forms a friendship with this creature. And it turns out this creature has been known about in mythology for a long time, but people generally understand it like they understand things that they don't know. They don't, you know, when they don't understand something, they fear it, and that leads to a load of stories about this thing that aren't strictly accurate. So part of one of the stories that is told within the book is the original Call of Cthulhu story, where there's the ship that sails from New Zealand and the sailors who encounter Cthulhu. It retells that story, but you see it from a different perspective, and actually it kind of reframes what you think about this creature and its origins, and tells it through the eyes of this child who befriends it. And it's a very sort of an isolated story, in that he's kind of, for the most part of the story, he's the only one who ever sees this thing. And I always like that kind of a child's thing, where the child sort of leaves the normal dreary life and goes to somewhere where something special happens and then sort of comes back. I think that gives it something sort of special as a child's story, because that's how it's almost like it's in your imagination then, like when the kid goes away to whatever place they're imagining and the grown-ups around them aren't a part of that, so it's sort of going for that sort of a feel. But everyone who's read it has just gone absolutely crazy over it, so yeah, I'm hoping it gets picked up by this publisher, because it's something I've been working on quite passionately for about 3 years now.
Wow.
Awesome. Awesome. I hope it does. I want to see that. I want a copy of that. Sounds great.
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds great. Yeah, I always wanted to write a kid's story. I don't think I could, to be honest. I don't know.
The way I write it is different to I don't know if there's a right way to write a children's story, but it's the way that I talk to children as well, because I've got a niece and nephew, and I basically refuse to talk to children like the children. All I do is I talk to them like they're an adult, but I just monitor what I say. So I won't use swear words, and I won't talk about certain topics. But the language that I use and the way in which I speak to them is the same as I would to an adult, because I find it patronizing to do that kind of downward talking that people seem to insist on doing. You're like, oh, have you been at school today? You don't need to talk to them like that. It's not necessary.
And
it's the same with my writing. I write it the same as I would write for anybody, but I'm more careful about what words I'll use in terms of, you know, the complexity and that kind of thing. But the way I write it doesn't have that kind of stereotypical children's book voice, because I don't personally agree with that as a method.
Yeah. No, I would agree. No, that's good.
What age bracket is the book? Is it like a tween or even younger?
I think younger, but it does depend on whether the kid is reading it themselves or whether the parent is reading it to them. So like, I think if they're about 8 or 9, they could sit and read it themselves, but the story doesn't have anything in it that would prevent it being read to them by younger. Like if they were younger than that, the parent was reading it to them, it would work for that as well.
With James saying that he doesn't think he'd be able to write a children's book, it just reminded me, we had an author one time, a horror author, come on the show, and we were talking about, I think it was romance, and he was like, I don't think I could write a love story, because I think, you know, something would happen around the first kill, you know, and it just was so funny.
Yeah.
So that was great.
I think as a writer, you are capable of more than you think. It's one of the reasons that I don't ever like to pigeonhole myself. Like, because stories that I'm known for now are horror, people often describe me as a horror author, but I'm not. It's one thing that I've done, but I've also wrote crime. I've wrote literary fiction. I'm now going to be doing a children's book. I don't want to slap that label on yourself, because it's a very narrow field then of what people expect from you. So. But I mean, it's the same for Stephen King, isn't it? Like you mentioned Stephen King earlier, people describe him as a horror author, but at least half of his books aren't horror. So people still go for that label, don't they?
Yeah. Well, half the time in the trilogy of Bill Hodges' books are probably some of the finest things he's written, you know, in his recent years, and they're not horror.
Sure.
No, I mean, they're horrific.
No,
absolutely. There's no monsters, no supernatural, anything. They're incredibly well done, and you know I like those. So yeah, but it is very easy to get pigeonholed. And I think once you do get, you sort of get pigeonholed as a horror author, it sticks. It does stick.
Yeah, it seems to be doing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People look at you like you're sort of, you know, when you write horror, and they just look at you like you're some sort of, you know, psychopath, which is always jolly at kids' parties, I find.
Right. Well, I hate to say this, but we're just about out of time for our first segment. You have to promise to come back and see us, Lex.
Yes, absolutely. Anytime, yeah.
Yay. And
It's been fun. It's always nice to speak to somebody from the home counties, as it were.
Yeah, certainly.
And tell us real quick where we can find you online.
My Facebook author page is Lex H. Jones. That's my actual business page. And if you find me on Twitter, it's at Lex H. Jones. Those are the best places to find my updates for what I'm doing and where you can buy my books and stuff.
And obviously, on the Hellbound Books website as well, naturally.
Yes, of course. Yep.
So you can find him there as well, people. Buy the book.
Yeah.
It is. It is. It is a. And also, and I have to say, again, just a shout out to the artist who did the cover art as well. It's a
oh yeah, I've had so much people tell me about that cover. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it would make a great T-shirt. That
yes, it would. Yeah.
Well, so, I will get your links put up on our Facebook page.
It's been an absolute. She's still waffling on. She every week. She just waffles. She cannot be quiet. She really. Maybe she should buy some beads or something, or some little shiny keys to play with. But it's been an absolute pleasure, Lex. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I think that was it. Are you still there?
Was it? I am. I was enjoying that, though. That was a lot of fun sitting back and drinking and listening. I was listening.
Me too. It's a rare treat to sit and listen to us, I suppose. But, I was entertained. I heard it all this afternoon. And, of course, I edited it, obviously, badly. Yeah. But, so I've heard it a couple of times now. And I have to say, I found it very entertaining. I enjoyed it. Brilliant guest. And Lex, obviously, great to talk to somebody from my home county, somebody who lives 20 minutes down the road from where I grew up, which is fantastic. Charles was superb as well. You managed to get some good guests, which is credit to you, I guess.
That's what I do.
Because I sure as hell have nothing to do with that at all.
I know. If it's down to me,
there'd be no one. There would be no one.
I wasn't just sitting here twiddling my thumbs. I was looking for more guests because I'm thinking it is my job to do that. And So I have.
Well, Charles mentioned Dacre Stoker, who I know you're talking to.
Having
him on the show. At some point, we're hoping to get. I need to speak to him actually. Get J.R. Lansdale on as well. So in fact, I'm going to try and get because he's close personal friend Paul T. Taylor, who played Pinhead in the latest Hellraiser movie. I'm going to try and snaggle him for the show as well. He would be great to talk to. So
heck yeah.
Yeah, so all these great authors and great names covers up for our lack of talent in many ways. I feel.
Definitely. I just had a. Do you remember when we had Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne on the show?
We did the song. Yes, I do remember them incredibly well. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Alistair, he's just agreed to come back to the show soon. So
fall out or?
No, both him and Tamara. They'll be, they're always together. So for that
occasion, you must let me know in advance. I will have a full copy of the song from Annie. A full copy. I will make you listen to the whole 3 minute song because I think that'll be worth doing.
That'll be worth doing.
Mm-hmm. So I'm getting tired now.
Me too. It's about that time.
Well, with the accumulation of obviously having spring break last week for Mike, so I managed to get a bit of a lie in, and then the clocks going forward and then, Monday morning an hour less in bed, which sort of threw me out for the entire week, to tell you the truth.
It always takes
me a couple of weeks to sort of readjust my circadian rhythm, but and then just getting it back again, and the clocks will go back. So, but of course, the scary thing now is obviously I think your kids off at spring break now, and it's now countdown to summer. My son merrily announced it's another 9 weeks and 8 weeks after tomorrow, and it's summer break. Like shit.
I know. I'm thinking boarding school or summer school or something. Or I just need a vacation. I don't know.
Summer school. Shit. My eldest ended up in summer school because he flunked. I think it was geometry. I think this is a few years back. And there's no buses. You have to take them. It was summer, I was getting up at fucking 6:30 to take him to summer school and then bring him back. Like, I've threatened my eldest, eldest that's at home. You know, he'll walk, or I'll just drop him off and stay there for the whole fortnight. I'm not running backwards and forwards. So that's incentive not to fail anything. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think it's just about time now. So I've prepared, again, apologies to anybody, all our non-UK, in fact, all our non-Yorkshire listeners, but I wanted a good typical Yorkshire song for Lex's benefit. So if we say, it is that time to say goodnight, Xtina, we will play the song. Goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Never forget that first day at Pitt. Me and my father worked a 72-hour shift, and then we walked home 43 miles through snow in his bare feet, huddled inside his clothes made out of old sacks. Eventually we trudged over hill until we could see street light twinkling in our village. My father smiled down at me through icicles hanging off his nose. "Nearly home now, lad," he said. We stumbled into house and stood there freezing cold and tired out, shivering and miserable in front of meagre fire. "Any road," my mum says, "cheer up, lads. I've got you some nice brown bread and butter for your tea." My father went crackers. He reached out and gently pulled my mum towards him, bit throat. "You big, fat, idle, ugly wart," he said. "You great, useless, spawny-eyed, parrot-faced wazzock." He had a way with words, my father. He'd been to college, you know. "You've been out playing bingo all afternoon instead of getting some proper snap ready for me and this lad," he explained to me poor little purple-faced mam. Then turning to me, he said, "Arthur?" He could never remember my name. "Here's half a crown. Nip down to Chipoil and get us a nice piece of haddock for us tea. Man cannot live by bread alone." You were a right day to me, father. He said as our working folk should have some dignity and pride and self-respect, and as how they should come home to something warm and cheerful. And then he threw me mum on fire. We didn't have no tellies or shoes or bedclothes. We made us own fun in them days. Do you know, when I were a lad, you could get a tram down into town, buy 3 new suits and an overcoat, 4 pair of good boots, go and see George for me at Palace Theatre, get blind drunk, have some steak and chips, bunch of bananas and 3 stone of monkey nuts, and still have change out in a farthing. With lots of things in them days, they haven't got today. Rickets, diphtheria, Hitler, and Barry did look well going to school with no backside in his trousers and all his little heads painted purple because we had ringworm. They don't know they're born today.